A reduced set. As evening fell, Prometheus stood and stretched with a yawn and that special groan of weariness and satisfaction that follows a long session of concentrated labour. The afternoon sun had warmed his work into the supple, malleable consistency known in the world of ceramics as cheeseware. This was perfect timing on Prometheus's part, for if the finished creations had been exposed to fiercer midday heat, they would have dried into biscuitware, rendering them too friable and frangible for any of the last-minute modifications that his royal and divine patron would be sure to demand. Longer ears, twice the number of genitals, that kind of thing. Gods are nothing if not capricious. And here, unless his own ears deceived him, came the king of the gods now, crashing through the thicket in loud conversation with someone. Prometheus could make out an answering voice, female, low and measured. Zeus had brought along Athena, his favourite child. "Your father, the emperor god, the world knows," Prometheus could hear him saying. "Zeus the all-powerful, yes. Zeus the all-conquering, certainly. Zeus the all-knowing, of course. Zeus the all-modest? Zeus the creator, though. Doesn't that have a ring?" "Quite a ring." "Now then, the river bank should be just over there. Let's call him." "Oh, Prometheus!" Roosting weaver birds rocketed into the air, squawking in alarm. "Prometheus!" "Over here," Prometheus called. "But be careful, because..." Too late. Breaking out through the trees into the clearing, Zeus had, in his excitement, stepped onto the row of exquisitely fashioned figures drying on the bank. With a cry of fury and despair, Prometheus hurried forward to survey the damage. "You clumsy oaf!" he cried. "You've destroyed them! Look!" No one else in creation could get away with talking to Zeus like that. Athena was astonished to see her father bow his head in meek apology. On inspection, things were not quite as bad as Prometheus had feared. Only three of the figures were beyond repair. He prized these from the mud, the squashed clay still bearing the imprint of Zeus's enormous toes. "Oh, good," said Zeus cheerfully. "The rest are fine. That's plenty. Let's get on, shall we?" "But look at these," said Prometheus, holding up the squashed and ruined statuettes. "The little green, violet and blue creatures were just about my favourites. We've still got the black, brown, ivory, yellow, reddish and what have you. That's enough, surely." "I really loved that shade of cobalt blue." Athena was looking down at the intact figures, which lay glowing in the dying rays of the sun. "Oh, Prometheus, they are perfect," she said, in the mild voice that commanded more attention than the roars and screams of the other Olympians. Prometheus cheered up at once. Praise from Athena meant everything. "Well, I did pretty much put my heart and soul into them." "Fine job, really fine," said Zeus. "Formed by a great titan from Gaia's clay, they are held together by my royal saliva, and fired by the sun, and shall be brought to life by the gentle breath of my daughter." It was Metis, always inside Zeus, who had sparked the thought in him that it should be Athena who brought these creatures to life. She would breathe into each one, literally inspiring them, with some of her great qualities of wisdom, instinct, craft, and sense. A name is found. Kneeling down on the bank of the river, Athena breathed her warm, sweet breath into each of the little statues. When she had finished, she stood to join Prometheus and her father, looking on to see what would transpire. It all happened quite slowly. At first, one of the darker figures gave a twitch and let out a kind of gasping moan. At the other end of the row, a yellow one wriggled, sat up, and gave a small cough. Within seconds, all the little beings were alive and moving. Just moments later, they were trying out their limbs, eyes, and other senses, looking at each other, smelling the air, chattering and shouting. Before long, they were standing and even taking their first wobbling steps. Zeus took Prometheus by both his hands and danced him round and round. "Look!" he shouted. "Look! Aren't they beautiful? They are wonderful, quite wonderful!" Athena raised a finger to her lips. "Shh, you're frightening them." She pointed down at the tiny men who were now staring up with looks of fear and consternation on their faces. The tallest of them didn't quite come up to the level of her knees. "It's all right, little ones," said Zeus, stooping down and addressing them in what he hoped was a soothing voice. "There's no need to be afraid." But the colossal booming sound that emerged seemed to alarm the little creatures further, and they began to flail and whirl about in fear. "Let's reduce ourselves to their size," said Prometheus. As he spoke, he shrank himself down so that he was only a foot or so taller than his creations. Zeus and Athena did the same. With embraces, smiles, and soft words, the scared and bewildered beings were slowly pacified and befriended. They clustered around the three immortals, bowing and prostrating themselves. "There's no need to bow," said Prometheus, touching one of them and marvelling at the texture and life he could feel pounding within. Athena's breath had turned the clay into such quick, warm flesh. The eyes of them all were bright with life and energy and hope. "Excuse me," said Zeus, "there is every need to bow. We are their gods, and they are not to forget it." "I'm not their god," said Prometheus, gazing down on them with an intense feeling of love and pride. "I am their friend." He knelt so that he was on their level. "I shall teach them how to farm, how to mill wheat and rye so that they can make bread, how to cook and forge tools, and—" "No!" Zeus gave a sudden roar that sent the startled creatures milling in panic again. Zeus's roar was answered by a great rumble of thunder in the sky. "You can befriend them as much as you like, Prometheus, and I have no doubt that Athena and all the other gods will do so too, but one thing they are not to have, ever, and that is fire." Prometheus stared at his friend in astonishment. But why ever not? With fire, they could rise up to challenge us. With fire, they could think themselves our equals. I feel it and know it. They must never be given fire. I have spoken." A long peal of thunder in the distance affirmed his words. "But," Zeus smiled now, "everything else in the world is theirs to enjoy. They may travel to every corner. They can sail Poseidon's oceans, seek Demeter's help in sowing seeds and growing food, learn from Hestia the arts of keeping a home, discover how to keep animals for their milk, fur, and labour. They can learn the arts of hunting from Artemis. Hermes can teach them guile. Apollo can instruct them in the arts of music and learning. Athena will teach them how to be wise and contented. And Aphrodite will share with them the arts of love. They will be free and happy." "What shall we call them?" Athena asked. "That which is below," said Zeus, after some thought. "Anthropos." That is one theory as to the origin of the word anthropos, which does strictly mean man. It is unfortunate that many words for our species seem to refer only to the male. Human, for example, is cognate with homo, the Latin for man. Thus, humanity rudely leaves out half the species. Folk and people aren't so specific. It is worth bearing in mind, however, that man is actually connected to mens, mind, and manus, hand, and was in fact gender neutral until perhaps 1,000 years ago. Zeus clapped his hands, and the huddle of handcrafted humans became 100, and 100 became a horde, and the horde, spreading ever outwards, became a multitude, until the human population, numbering now in the hundreds of thousands, was on its way to finding a home in every corner of the world. And so the early race of man came to be. Gaia, Zeus, Apollo, and Athena might be said to be its progenitors as much as Prometheus, who fashioned humanity from the four elements: earth, Gaia's clay, water, the spittle of Zeus, fire, the son of Apollo, and air, the breath of Athena. They lived and thrived, exemplifying the best of their creators. But something was missing. Something very important. The Golden Age. Alma Mater, the bountiful Mother Earth, was a sweet paradise for the first men. They knew no disease, poverty, famine, or war. Life was an idyll of innocence and light pastoral duties. It was a time of happy worship of, and familiarity and even friendship with, the deities, who moved amongst them in easy, unfrightening shapes and dimensions. It gave Zeus and the other gods, titans, and immortals great pleasure to mingle with the charming, childlike homunculi that Prometheus had shaped from clay. Perhaps we only imagined these first days of beautiful simplicity and universal kindness, so that we could have a high point of paradisal sublimity against which to judge the low, degraded times that came after. The later Greeks certainly believed that the Golden Age had truly existed. It was ever present in their thinking and poetry, and gave them a dream of perfection to aspire to, a vision more concrete and realized than our own vague ideas of early man grunting in caves. Platonic ideals and perfect forms were perhaps the intellectual expression of that wistful race memory. It was natural that of all the immortals, the one who loved humankind best should be their artist-creator, Prometheus. He and his brother Epimetheus now spent more time living with man than they spent on Olympus in the company of their fellow immortals. It saddened Prometheus that he had only been allowed to create male people, for he felt that this cloned, single-sex race lacked variety both in its outlook, disposition, and character, and in its inability to breed and create new types. His humans were happy, yes, but to Prometheus, such a safe, unchallenged, and unchallenging existence had no zest to it. To approach the godlike status that his creation deserved, mankind needed something more. It needed fire. Real, hot, fierce, flickering, flaming fire to enable them to melt, smelt, roast, toast, boil, broil, fashion, and forge. And they needed, too, an inner, creative fire, a divine fire, to enable them to think, imagine, dare, and do. The more he watched over and mingled with his creation, the more Prometheus became convinced that fire was exactly what they needed. And he knew where to find it. the fennel stalk. Prometheus surveyed the twin crowns of Olympus towering above him. The tallest peak, Mytikos, reached nearly 10,000 podes high into the clouds. Next to it, 200 or 300 or so feet lower, but much harder to climb, reared the rocky face of Stefani. To the west loomed the heights of Scolio. Prometheus knew that the dying rays of the evening sun would shield that climb, the toughest of all, from the gods enthroned above, and so he began the perilous ascent, confident that he could reach the summit unseen. Prometheus had never disobeyed Zeus before, not in anything big, in games and races and wrestling matches and competitions to win the hearts of nymphs. He had freely teased and taunted his friend, but he had never defied him outright. The hierarchy of the pantheon was not something any being could disrupt without real consequences. Zeus was a beloved friend, but he was, above all, Zeus. Yet Prometheus was determined on his course of action. Much as he had always loved Zeus, he found that he loved mankind more. The excitement and resolution he felt was stronger than any fear of divine wrath. He hated to cross his friend, but when it came to a choice, there was no choice. By the time he had scaled Scolio's sheer wall, the western gates had closed upon Apollo's chariot of the sun, and the whole mountain was shrouded in darkness. Crouching low, Prometheus made his way around the jagged outcrop that crested the bowl-like amphitheatre of Megala Kazaneer. Looking ahead, he could see the plateau of the Muses beyond, flickering with dancing licks of light thrown by the fires of Hephaestus's forge, a stadion or so farther off. Around the other side of Olympus, the gods were supping. Prometheus could hear Apollo's lyre, Hermes fluting Syrinx, the raucous laugh of Ares, and the snarling of Artemis' hounds. Hugging the outer walls of the forge, the Titan edged along to its forecourt. He was startled as he rounded the corner to see stretched out naked on the ground the huge figure of Brontes, snoring by the fire. Prometheus hung back in the shadows. He knew that the Cyclopes assisted Hephaestus, but that they might sleep on the premises was more than he had bargained for. At the very mouth of the forge, he saw a narthex plant, sometimes called the laserwort or giant fennel, Ferula communis, not quite the same bulbous vegetable we use today to impart a pleasant aniseedy flavour to fish, but a near enough relation. Narthex came to mean the outer porch to a church or temple, a place for penitents to gather before admittance. The stalk itself is sometimes represented as a thyrsus tipped with a pine cone, like the decorative finials used for curtains today. Prometheus leant forward and picked a long, vigorous specimen. Tightly packed within, there was a thick, lint-like pith. Stripping the stem of its outer leaves, Prometheus leant forward and pushed the stalk out across the forecourt, over Brontes' slumbering, mumbling form, and towards the fire. The heat emanating from the furnace was enough to cause the end of the stalk to catch at once. Prometheus pulled it back in with as much care as he could, but he could not prevent a spark from falling from its sputtering end straight down onto Brontes' torso. The skin on the Cyclops' chest sizzled and hissed, and he awoke with a roar of pain. As he looked groggily down at his chest, trying to understand where this pain was coming from and what it could mean, Prometheus hauled in the stalk and fled. The Gift of Fire. Prometheus clambered back down Olympus, the fennel stalk clenched between his teeth, its pith burning slowly. Every 5 minutes or so, he would take it from his mouth and blow gently, nursing its glow. When he at last reached the safety of the valley floor, he made his way to the human settlement where he and his brother had made their home. You may say that Prometheus could surely have had the wit to teach man to strike stones together or rub sticks, but we have to remember that what Prometheus stole was fire from heaven, divine fire. Perhaps he took the inner spark that ignited in man the curiosity to rub sticks and strike flints in the first place. When he first showed men the leaping, dancing, darting demon, they cried out in fear and backed away from its flames. But their curiosity soon overcame their fear, and they began to delight in this magical new toy, substance, phenomenon, call it what you will. They learned from Prometheus that fire was not their enemy, but a powerful friend which, once tamed, had 10,000,000 uses. Prometheus moved from village to village, demonstrating techniques for the fashioning of tools and weapons, the firing of earthen pots, the cooking of meat, and the baking of cereal doughs, all of which quickly let loose an avalanche of advantages, raising man up above the animal prey that had no answer to metal-tipped spears and arrows. It was not long before Zeus chanced to look down from Olympus and saw points of dancing orange light dotting the landscape all around. He knew at once what had happened. Nor did he need to be told who was responsible. His anger was swift and terrible. Never had such almighty, such tumultuous, such apocalyptic fury been witnessed. Not even Uranus, in his mutilated agony, had been so filled with vengeful rage. Uranus was brought low by a son he had no regard for, but Zeus had been betrayed by the friend he loved most. No betrayal could be more terrible. The Punishments. The Gift. Zeus's wrath was so overwhelming that all Olympus feared Prometheus would be blasted with such power that his atoms would never reassemble. It is possible that just such a fate may have befallen the once-favored Titan, had not the wise and stabilizing presence of Metis inside Zeus's head counseled a subtler and more dignified revenge. The intensity of his rage was in no way dimmed, but rather it was now focused, channeled into clearer lines of retribution. He would leave Prometheus for the time being and unleash his cosmic fury upon man, puny, impudent man, the creature he had taken such delight in and for whom now he felt nothing but resentment and cold contempt. For a whole week, watched by a grave and concerned Athena, the king of the gods paced up and down in front of his throne, considering how best humans should pay for daring to appropriate fire, for presuming to ape the gods. A voice within him seemed to whisper that one day, no matter what vengeance he took, mankind would reach ever upwards until they came level with the gods, or perhaps more terribly, until they no longer needed the gods and felt free to abandon them. No more worship, no more prayers sent up to heavenly Olympus. The prospect was too blasphemous and absurd for Zeus to entertain, but the fact that such a scandalous idea could even enter his mind served only to fuel his rage. Whether the magnificent scheme that was finally put into operation was his, or Metis's, or even Athena's, is unclear, but it was, Zeus believed, a screamer of a plan. There was a golden symmetry to it that appealed to his very Greek mind. He would show Prometheus, and by heaven, he would show mankind. First, he commanded Hephaestus to do as Prometheus had done, to shape a human being from clay moistened by his spittle. But this was to be the figure of a young female. Taking his wife Aphrodite, his mother Hera, his aunt Demeter, and his sister Athena as models, Hephaestus lovingly sculpted a girl of quite marvellous beauty, into whom Aphrodite then breathed life and all the arts of love. The other gods joined together to equip this girl uniquely for the world. Athena trained her in the household crafts, embroidery, and weaving, and dressed her in a glorious silver robe. The Charites were put in charge of accessorizing this with necklaces, brooches, and bracelets of the finest pearl, agate, jasper, and chalcedony. The Horae plaited flowers around her hair until she was so beautiful that all who saw her caught their breath. Hera endowed her with poise and self-possession. Hermes schooled her in speech and the arts of deception, curiosity, and cunning. And he gave her a name. Since each of the gods had conferred upon her a notable talent or accomplishment, she was to be called All-Gifted, which in Greek is Pandora. It is a subtler name than that, for Pandora can mean the All-Giving, as well as the All-Given. Hephaestus bestowed one more gift upon this paragon, which Zeus presented himself. It was a container filled with secrets. Now, you probably think I'm going to say the container was a box, or perhaps a chest of some description, but in fact it was the kind of glazed and sealed earthenware jar that is known in Grecian lands as a pithos. It is said to have been Erasmus, of all people, the great 16th-century scholar and prince of the humanists, who mistranslated Pandora's pithos jar into pyxis, box. "Here you are, my dear," said Zeus. "Now, this is purely decorative. You are never, ever to open it. You understand?" Pandora shook her lovely head.
"Never," she breathed with great sincerity. "Never."
"There's a good girl. It is your wedding gift. Bury it deep below your marriage bed, but you must not open it. Ever. What it contains, well, never mind. Nothing of interest to you at all." Hermes took Pandora by the hand and transported her to the little stone house where Prometheus and his brother Epimetheus lived, right in the centre of a prosperous human town. The Brothers. The first race that populated what we think of as Greece called themselves the Pelasgians, after Pelasgos, one of the original clay models Prometheus had made and into whom Athena had breathed life. Pelasgos was what we would consider ethnically Hellenic, with brownish skin, hair, and eyes. Later Greeks regarded these people, their languages and practices, as barbaric. And as we shall see, this first race was not fated to populate the Mediterranean for long. Prometheus knew that Zeus would seek some kind of retribution for his disobedience,
and warned his brother Epimetheus that while he was away teaching the newly sprung up villages and towns how to use fire, he should on no account accept any gift from Olympus, no matter in what guise it presented itself. Epimetheus, who always acted first and considered the consequences later, promised to obey his more perspicacious brother. Nothing could prepare him for Zeus's gift, however. Epimetheus answered a knock at the door one morning to see the cheerful, smiling face of the messenger of the gods. "May we come in?" Hermes stepped nimbly aside to reveal, cradling a stoneware jar in her arms, the most beautiful creature Epimetheus had ever seen. Aphrodite was beautiful, of course she was, but too remote and ethereal to be considered as anything other than a subject of veneration and distant awe. Likewise, Demeter, Artemis, Athena, Hestia, and Hera, their loveliness was majestic and unattainable. The prettiness of nymphs, oreads, and oceanids, while enchanting enough, seemed shallow and childish, next to the blushing sweetness of the vision that looked up at him so shyly, so winningly, so adorably. "May we?" repeated Hermes. Epimetheus gulped, swallowed, and stepped backwards, opening the door wide. "Meet your wife-to-be," said Hermes. "Her name is Pandora." When It's Ajar. Epimetheus and Pandora were soon married. Epimetheus had an idea that Prometheus, who was far away, teaching the art of casting in bronze to the people of Varanasi, would not approve of Pandora. A quick wedding before his brother returned seemed to be a good idea. Epimetheus and Pandora were very much in love. That could not be denied. Pandora's beauty and attainments were such as to delight him every day, and in return his facile ability to live always for the moment and never to fret about the future gave her a sense of life as a light and lovely adventure. But one little itch tickled her. One little fly buzzed around her. One little worm burrowed inside. That jar. She kept it on a shelf in their bedroom. When Epimetheus had asked about it, she laughed. "Just a silly thing that Hephaestus made me to remind me of Olympus. It's of no value." "Pretty, though," said Epimetheus, giving it no further thought. One afternoon, when her husband was away practicing the discus with his friends, Pandora approached the jar and ran her finger round the rim of its sealed lid. Why had Zeus even mentioned that there was nothing interesting inside it? He would never have said such a thing if truly there weren't. She pieced the logic of it together in her mind. If you give a friend an empty jar, you would never concern yourself with mentioning that the jar was empty. Your friend might look inside one day and see that for themselves. So why should Zeus take the trouble to repeat that this jar contained nothing of any interest? There could only be one explanation. There was something of great interest inside, something of value or power, something either enchanting or enchanted. But no, she had sworn never to open it. A promise is a promise, she told herself, and straight away felt very virtuous. She felt it her duty to resist the spell of the jar, which now really seemed almost to be singing out to her in the most alluring way. It was excessively vexing to have an object so bewitching in her bedroom, where it could taunt and tempt her every morning and every night. Temptation loses much of its power when removed from sight. Pandora went to the small back garden, and next to a sundial that a neighbour had given them as a wedding gift, she dug a hole and buried the jar deep in the ground. She patted the earth flat and wheeled the heavy sundial on its plinth over the hiding place. There! For the next week, she was as gay and skittish and happy as a person had ever been. Epimetheus fell even more in love with her and invited their friends over to feast and hear a song he had written in her honour. It was a happy and successful party, the last festival that the Golden Age was ever to know. That night, perhaps a little flushed with the praise that had flowed so freely in her direction, Pandora found it hard to sleep. Through the window of her bedroom, the moonlight shone down on the garden. The sundial's gnomon gleamed like a silver blade, and once again she thought she heard the music of the jar. Epimetheus was sleeping happily beside her. The moonbeams danced in the garden. Unable to stand it any longer, Pandora leapt down from her matrimonial bed and was out in the garden, unrolling the base of the sundial and scrabbling at the earth before she had time to tell herself that this was the wrong thing to do. She pulled the jar from its hiding place and twisted at the lid. Its waxen seal gave way, and she pulled it free. There was a fast fluttering, a furious flapping of wings, and a wild wheeling and whirling in her ears. Oh, glorious flying creatures! But no, they were not glorious at all. Pandora cried out in pain and fright as she felt something leathery brush her neck, followed by a sharp and terrible prick of pain as some sting or bite pierced her skin. More and more flying shapes buzzed from the mouth of the jar, a great cloud of them chattering, screaming, and howling in her ears. Through the swirling fog of these dreadful creatures, she saw the face of her husband as he came outside to see what was happening. It was white with horror and fright. With a great cry, Pandora summoned up the courage and strength to close the lid and seal the jar. On the garden wall, in the shape of a wolf, Zeus looked on, smiling the most terrible and wicked smile, as, like a cloud of locusts, the shrieking, wailing creatures clawed the air and circled the garden below them in a great vortex before flying up and away over the town, over the countryside, and around the world, settling like a pestilence wherever man had habitation. And what were they? These shapes. They were mutant descendants of the dark and evil children of Nyx and Erebus. They were born of Apate, deceit, Geras, old age, Oises, misery, Momos, blame, Keres, violent death. They were the offshoots of Ate, ruin, and Eris, discord. These were their names: Ponos, hardship, Limos, starvation, Algos, pain, Dysnomia, anarchy, Pseudia, lies, Nikea, quarrels, Amphilogiae, disputes, Machai, wars, Hisminae, battles, Androctasiae and Phonoi, manslaughters and murders. Illness, violence, deceit, misery, and want had arrived. They would never leave the earth. What Pandora did not know was that when she shut the lid of the jar so hastily, she forever imprisoned inside one last daughter of Nyx, One last little creature was left behind to beat its wings hopelessly in the jar forever. Its name was Elpis, Hope. The Chest, the Waters, and the Bones of Gaia. And so the Golden Age came to a swift and terrible end. Death, disease, poverty, crime, famine, and war were now an inevitable and eternal part of humanity's lot. But the Silver Age, as this epoch was to be known, wasn't all despair. It differed from our own in that gods, demigods, and monsters mingled with mankind, interbred with us, and fully involved themselves in our lives. With fire on their side, and now women to allow propagation, as well as a full sense of family and completeness, some of the evils of Pandora's jar were offset. Zeus looked down and saw this. Inside him, the voice of Metis seemed to whisper that nothing he could do would stop humanity from one day standing on its own two feet in more than just the obvious sense. This troubled him deeply. For the meantime, people were duly in awe of the gods and used their newfound affinity with fire to send burnt offerings up to Olympus as a mark of their obedience and devotion. Pandora, the first woman, bore children by Epimetheus, including a daughter, Pyrrha. Prometheus, too, fathered a child, a son called Deucalion, possibly by Prometheus's own mother Clymene, or, if other sources are to be believed, by Hesione, an Oceanid. Not to be confused with the later Hesione, a princess of Troy. And so, the race of men and women multiplied. Prometheus, whose gift of foresight never deserted him, foresight but not prophecy, was keenly aware that Zeus's anger had yet to be assuaged. He brought Deucalion up to be prepared for the worst kinds of divine retribution. When the boy was old enough, he taught him the art of building in wood. Together they constructed an enormous chest. The brother Titans were overjoyed when their children Pyrrha and Deucalion fell in love and married. Prometheus and Epimetheus could now think of themselves as patriarchs of a new, independent human dynasty. Yet always there lurked the threat from the Thunderer, brooding on his Olympian throne. Time passed, and humanity continued to breed and spread, in Zeus's eyes more like a plague than the beloved playthings he had once adored. The excuse he needed to visit a second punishment on mankind was furnished by one of their first rulers, Lycaon, king of Arcadia, son of the Pelasgos who gave the Pelasgians their name. This Pelasgos, you recall, had been one of the original clay figures formed by Prometheus and animated by Athena. Lycaon, either to test Zeus's omniscience and discrimination, or for other brutal reasons, killed and roasted the flesh of his own son, Nyctimus, which he served to the god, who had come as a guest to a feast at his palace. Zeus was so revolted by this unspeakably gross act that he brought the boy back to life and turned Lycaon into a wolf. Another English word for a werewolf is lycanthrope, Greek for wolf-man. Nyctimus had little time to reign in his father's stead, however, as his 49 brothers ravaged the land with such violence and behaved so disgustingly that Zeus decided it was time for the whole human experiment to be brought to a close. To that end, he gathered the clouds into a storm so intense that the land was flooded, and all the people of Greece and the Mediterranean world were drowned. All save Deucalion and Pyrrha, who, thanks to the perspicacity of Prometheus, survived the 9 days of high water aboard their wooden chest, which floated safely on the waters. Like good survivalists, they had kept their chest well provisioned with food, drink, and a few useful tools and artifacts, so that when the flood waters finally receded and their raft was able to settle on Mount Parnassus, they could survive in the post-diluvian mud and slime. Mount Parnassus, according to Ovid, at least. Other sources suggest Mount Etna or Mount Athos. Round about the same time, Noah was landing on Mount Ararat. Archaeology confirms, it seems, that there really was a great flood. When the world had dried enough for Pyrrha and Deucalion, who is said to have been 82 years old at this time, to travel safely down the mountainside, they made their way to Delphi, which lies in the valley below Parnassus. There they consulted the oracle of Themis, the prophetic Titaness, whose special quality was an understanding of the right thing to do. O Themis, mother of justice, peace, and order, instruct us, we beseech you, they cried. We are alone in the world now, and too advanced in years to fill this empty world with children. Children of Prometheus and Epimetheus, the oracle intoned, hear my voice and do as I command. Cover your head and throw the bones of your mother over your shoulder. Not a word more could the perplexed couple induce the oracle to utter. My mother was Pandora, said Pyrrha, sitting on the ground, and I must presume she's drowned. Where could I find her bones? My mother is Clymene, said Deucalion, or, if you believe variant sources, she is the Oceanid Hesione. In either case, they are both immortals, and therefore alive, and surely unwilling to give up their bones. We must think, said Pyrrha. The bones of our mother. Can that have another meaning? Our mother's bones. Maternal bones. Think, Deucalion, think! Deucalion covered his head with a folded cloth, sat down next to his wife, whose head was already covered, and pondered the problem with creased brow. Oracles, they always paltered and prevaricated. Moodily, he picked up a rock and sent it rolling down the hillside. Pyrrha grabbed his arm. Our mother! Deucalion stared at her. She had started slapping the ground with the palms of her hands. Gaia! Gaia is mother of us all, she cried. Our mother Earth! These are the bones of our mother. Look! She started to gather up rocks from the ground. Come on! Deucalion got to his feet and scrabbled around, collecting rocks and stones. They made their way across the fields below Delphi, casting rocks and stones behind them, over their shoulders as instructed, but not daring to look back until they had covered many stadia. When they turned, the sight that greeted them filled their hearts with joy. From out of the ground where Pyrrha's stones had landed sprang girls and women, hundreds of them, smiling and healthy and fully formed. From the earth where Deucalion's stones fell, boys and men grew up. And so it was that the old Pelasgians drowned in the great deluge, and the Mediterranean world was repopulated by a new race, descended through Deucalion and Pyrrha from Prometheus, Epimetheus, Pandora, and, most importantly, of course, from Gaia. And that is who we are, a compound of foresight and impulse, of all gifts, and of the earth. death. Our human race, now satisfactorily comprised equally of males and females, bred and spread about the world, building cities and establishing nation-states. Ships and chariots, cottages and castles, culture and commerce, merchants and markets, farming and finance, weapons and wheat. In short, civilization began. It was an age of kings, queens, princes and princesses, of hunters, warriors, shepherds, potters and poets. An age of empires, slaves, warfare, trade and treaties. An age of votive offerings, sacrifices and worship. Towns and villages chose their favourite gods and goddesses to be guardian deities, patrons and protectors. The immortals themselves were not shy to come down in their own forms, or in the forms of humans and animals, to have their way with such humans as appealed to them, or to punish those that aggravated them, and reward those that most fawned on them. The gods never tired of flattery. Perhaps most importantly, the plague of sorrows that had flown from Pandora's jar ensured that from this point onwards, humanity would have to face the inevitability of death in all its forms. Sudden death, slow lingering death, death by violence, death by disease, death by accident, death by murder, and death by divine decree. The god Hades found, to his great delight, or the closest to delight that gloomy god could ever manage, that the shades of more and more dead humans began to arrive at his subterranean kingdom. Hermes was assigned a new role, that of arch-psychopomp, or chief conductor of souls, a duty he discharged with his customary sprightliness and puckish humour. Though, as the human population grew, only the most important dead were granted the honour of a personal escort by Hermes, the rest were taken by Thanatos, the grim, forbidding figure of death. The instant the human spirits departed their bodies, Hermes or Thanatos would lead them to the underground cavern where the river Styx, hate, met the river Acheron, woe. There, the grim and silent Charon held out his hand to receive his payment for ferrying the souls across the Styx. If the dead had no payment to offer, they would have to wait on the bank 100 years before the disobliging Charon consented to take them. To avoid this limbo, it became a custom amongst the living to place some money, usually an obolus, on the tongue of the dying to pay the ferryman and assure safe and swift passage. Not to be confused with the dagger-shaped punctuation mark, the obelus, this monetary piece was a spit or rod of copper and bronze, not like a coin at all as we think of them. When I was young, its value was equated to our old British halfpenny. There were 6 to a drachma, though originally a rather more casual and appealing handful of obols went to 1 drachma. 6 was apparently the most of these rods you could clutch in one hand. Charon was also happy to receive a danake, or danes, the Persian equivalent, later incorporated into Greek currency. When he had taken his fee, the ugly, long-bearded Charon would pull the dead soul aboard and pull his rust-coloured punt or skiff over the black Stygian waters to the disembarkation stage, hell's muster point. Virgil's description of Aeneas's visit to the underworld tells of the punt's colour. Once dead, no mortal could return to the upper world. Immortals, if they tasted so much as a morsel of food or drink in Hades, were fated to return. And what was their final destination? It seems that this rather depended on the kind of life they had led. At first, Hades himself was the arbiter, but in later years he delegated the great weighing up to the three sons of Zeus and Europa, Minos, Rhadamanthus, and Aeacus, who, after their own deaths, were appointed judges of the underworld. They decided whether an individual had lived a heroic, average, or punishably wicked life. The heroes, and those deemed exceedingly righteous, as well as the dead who had some divine blood in them, found themselves transported to the Elysian Fields, which lay somewhere on the archipelago known as the Fortunate Isles, or Isles of the Blessed. There is no real agreement as to where this might actually be. Perhaps they are what we now call the Canaries. The Canaries were Byron's candidate for the Isles of the Blessed in his Don Juan. Perhaps the Azores, the Lesser Antilles, or even Bermuda. Later descriptions place the Elysian Fields within the Kingdom of Hades itself, but not in France, despite the name of Paris's grand thoroughfare, the Champs-Élysées. In these accounts, souls who reincarnated three times, leading a heroic, just, and virtuous life each time, then earned themselves a transfer from Elysium to the Isles of the Blessed. The blameless majority, whose lives were neither especially virtuous nor especially vicious, might expect to be parked for eternity in the meadows of Asphodel, whose name derived from the white flowers that carpeted its fields. These souls were guaranteed a pleasant enough afterlife. Before they arrived, they drank the waters of forgetfulness from the river Lethe, so that a blithe and bland eternity could be passed, untroubled by upsetting memories of earthly life. But the sinners, the debauched, blasphemous, wicked, and dissolute, what of them? The least of them flitted in the halls of Hades eternally without feeling, strength, or any real consciousness of their existence, but the most profane and unpardonable were taken to the fields of punishment, which lay between the meadows of Asphodel and the abysmal depths of Tartarus itself. Here, tortures that fitted their crimes with diabolical exactness were inflicted on them for all eternity. We will meet some of the more celebrated of these sinners at a later date, names like Sisyphus, Ixion, and Tantalus still ring through the ages. While Homer describes the spirits of the departed as keeping the faces and appearance they had in life, alternative accounts tell of a hideous demon called Eurynomos, who met the dead and, like the Furies, stripped the flesh from their bones. Other poets suggest that the souls of the underworld were capable of speech and given to relating their life stories to each other. Hades was the most jealous of all his jealous family. Not one soul could he bear to lose from his kingdom. Cerberus, the three-headed dog, patrolled the gates. Few, very few, heroes circumvented or duped Thanatos and Cerberus and managed to visit Hades' realm and return alive to the world above. And so, death became a constant in human life, as it remains to this day. But the world of the Silver Age, it should be understood, was very different from our own. Gods, demigods, and all kinds of immortals still walked amongst us. Intercourse of the personal, social, and sexual kind with the gods was as normal to men and women of the Silver Age as intercourse with machines and AI assistants is to us today, and, I dare say, a great deal more fun. Prometheus Bound. With simmering fury, Zeus watched the survival of Pyrrha and Deucalion and the rise of a new race of men and women from the stones of the earth. No one, not even the king of the gods, could interfere with the will of Gaia. She represented an older, deeper, more permanent order than that of the Olympians, and Zeus knew that he was powerless to prevent the repopulation of the world. But he could at least turn his attention to Prometheus. The day dawned when Zeus decided the Titan should pay for his betrayal. He looked down from Olympus and saw him in Phocis, assisting in the laying out of a new town, meddling, as ever, in the affairs of men. Humankind had propagated in the twinkling of an immortal eye, which we would call the passage of several centuries. All this while, Prometheus had, with titanic patience, encouraged the spread of civilization amongst mankind 2.0, once again teaching people all the arts, crafts, and practices of agriculture, manufacture, and building. Adopting the form of an eagle, Zeus swooped down and perched on the timbers of a half-built temple that was to be dedicated to himself. Prometheus, who had been carving scenes from the life of the young Zeus into the pediment, looked up and knew at once that the bird was his old friend. Zeus assumed his proper shape and inspected the carving. "If that's supposed to be Adamantia with me there, you've got the proportions all wrong," he said. "Artistic license," said Prometheus, whose heart was beating fast. It was the first time the two had spoken since Prometheus stole the fire. "The time has come to pay for what you have done," said Zeus. "Now, I could call up the Hecatoncheires to carry you forcibly to your destination, or you can choose to bow to the inevitable and come without fuss." Prometheus laid down his hammer and chisel and wiped his hands with a leather cloth. "Let's go," he said. They did not speak or pause for rest or refreshment until they reached the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains, where the Black and Caspian Seas meet. Along the journey, Zeus had wanted to say something, had longed to take his friend by the shoulder and embrace him. A weeping apology might have allowed him to forgive and make up. But Prometheus remained silent. Zeus's stinging sense of being wronged and ill-used flared up anew. "Besides," he told himself, "great rulers cannot be seen to exhibit weakness, especially when it comes to betrayal by those close to them." Prometheus shaded his eyes and looked up. He saw the three Cyclopes standing on a great sloping wall of rock that formed one side of the tallest mountain. "I know you're good at climbing up the sides of mountains," Zeus said, with what he hoped was icy sarcasm, but which emerged even to his ears as something more like sulky muttering. "So climb." When Prometheus reached the place where the Cyclopes were, they bound and fettered him, and stretched him out on his back, hammering his shackles into the rock with mighty pegs of unbreakable iron. Two beautiful eagles swept down from the sky and glided close to Prometheus, blocking the sunlight. He could hear the hot wind ruffling their feathers. Zeus called up to him, "You will lie chained to this rock forever. There is no hope of escape or forgiveness, not in all perpetuity. Each day, these eagles will come to tear out your liver, just as you tore out my heart. They will eat it in front of your eyes. Since you are immortal, it will grow back every night. This torture will never end. Each day the agony will seem greater. You will have nothing but time in which to consider the enormity of your crime and the folly of your actions. You, who were named Foresight, showed none when you defied the king of the gods. Zeus's voice rang from the canyons and ravines. Well, have you nothing to say? Prometheus sighed. You are wrong, Zeus, he said. I thought my actions through with great care. I weighed my comfort against the future of the race of man. I see now that they will flourish and prosper independently of any immortals, even you. Knowing that is balm for any pain. Zeus stared at his former friend for a long time before speaking. You are not worth eagles, he said with an awful coldness. Let them be vultures. The two eagles immediately changed into rank, ugly vultures who circled the outstretched body once before falling upon it. Their razor-sharp talons sliced open the Titan's side, and with hideous screeches of triumph, they began to feast. Prometheus, mankind's chief creator, advocate, and friend, taught us, stole for us,